6.
Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is the 19th of June. We will continue listen to Tenzin's previous program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Race of Sun by Lam Kapow, and enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and thanks for joining the program. Last week, we ended with a BBC program titled The Hidden Upside of Revenge. If you were with us, you may remember the words of Michael McCullough, evolutionary psychologist at the University of Miami, who said, although people might say seeking revenge is really bad for you, that it ruins your relationships, for example, the fact that it exists at all is a very good thing. Its main goal is to work as a deterrent, which in turn has clear advantages for our survival. He continues with this. Consider prison or gang culture, where if you meddle with the wrong person, revenge attacks are a sure consequence. And a quote from David Chester, Virginia Commonwealth University, followed. If you have a reputation for someone who's going to seek retribution, people are not going to mess with you or take advantage. The article then pays homage to Leonardo DiCaprio's Oscar-winning performance in The Revenant, with so powerful is his desire for revenge that it keeps him alive. With broken bones and open wounds, he drags himself through a hostile and dangerous terrain to avenge his son's killer. It continues, even the threat of revenge might deter an attack, says McCullough. The individual who responds to that harm is going to do better than the individual who takes a slap on the cheek and lets the bad guy have his way. Just like hunger, he considers it a primal urge that needs to be itched. Only then can the avenger move on, because that goal has been fulfilled, in a similar way that we only stop feeling hungry after we've satiated our appetite. So if a main purpose of revenge is about deterring harm, it is a very good thing indeed. That's not to say, says McCullough, that we should encourage people to indulge in seeking revenge. We can both appreciate what it's for, understand it's not the product of afflictive minds, and also have an interest in helping people curtail their desire for revenge, he says. Now, this argument, understandably, doesn't take the effects of karma into consideration, which is something we as Buddhists definitely have to do. Not knowing another's mind, we cannot say whether an act of revenge, or even a threat of revenge, will be a deterrent or will just spur more aggression. Will revenge stop the cycle of violence or make it spin even more violently? And what will be the long-term effects on both parties' minds? From a spiritual point of view, in the long term, it's all bad. And Jesus and Buddha were right. The prisoner who makes sure every slight is repaid in spades is continuing to create an ever more claustrophobic and aggressive environment driven by his or her mental attitude. Such are the ingredients that the hell realms are made of. However, the BBC article goes on to take a more conciliatory tone and unknowingly acknowledges that some people's karma makes them more prone to thoughts of revenge than others. It says it might also be comforting to know that not everyone acts out on their desire to seek revenge. One 2006 study found that men get more pleasure from the idea of revenge. Male participants were found to have more activity in the reward circuit of the brain than women when they saw cheating opponents receive an electric shock. In another 2008 study, Oslam Ayiduk of the University of California, Berkeley and colleagues found that those with specific personality types were more likely to act violently after rejection. She found that in certain individuals had higher levels of rejection sensitivity and were more likely to expect rejection based on past experiences. These individuals were also found to be more neurotic and to show anxiety and depression. They have this tendency to see rejection even where it doesn't exist. Rejection is an existential threat, so that expectation of rejection actually prepares, both mentally and physiologically, the person to defend themselves, says Aiduk. Retaliatory aggression for these individuals was therefore a knee-jerk reaction to feeling rejected. But not everyone with a rejection-sensitive profile has violent tendencies. The article points out that some people cope with feelings of rejection in other ways, such as self-harm. Roslem Aiduk says that they are just looking for some measure of control. And the article continues, as well as that, those who are more prone to retaliatory aggression can learn ways to overcome their outbursts in a similar way that an addict can learn to control his or her urges with various psychological tactics. Winchester and Nathan Duvall of the University of Kentucky peered into individuals' brains during one of their revenge studies. They found that those who were able to restrain themselves from acting out showed brain activation in the lateral prefrontal cortex, an area known to be important for reasoning and inhibiting impulsive actions. Chester and Duvall say, so we're not doomed to succumb to our revengeful impulses. We have evolved this very sophisticated prefrontal cortex that can inhibit impulsive behavior and guide it to more social outcomes. There is hope whether we're aware of it or not. The article concludes with, so next time you are plotting revenge against someone who's wronged you, know that the anticipation of revenge may feel good in the moment, but don't expect these hidden upsides to last for long. Rather, understand that this feeling is there for a very good reason, and it could well have protected many of your ancient ancestors from being taken advantage of. His Holiness the Dalai Lama often makes the point that in the days of tribalism, acts like these tit-for-tat types of excursions to send a message and protect the existence of a community may have made some sense. But in today's global village, they have no place. We're coming to understand how dependent we all are on each other for survival, so it makes much better sense to find other, more peaceful ways of dealing with aggressors than taking revenge. Now, this whole discussion came about through our consideration of a slogan in the teachings of the text, Mind Training Likes the Rays of the Sun, by the ancient Tibetan master Nam Karpel. Don't wait in ambush is the slogan. But before we continue to discuss it, let's think about our motivation for this program today. Remember bodhicitta, the intention to attain enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. For that is the greatest motivation. Using it even in just this instance would bring so much benefit to your mind. So please try to make that your motivation. But if not, at least think of your own liberation. Thank you. Now don't wait in ambush. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche in Enlightened Courage says that ambush in this case means remembering the harm done to us by others and biding our time for a moment of weakness when we might strike back, seeking the help of the powerful or even resorting to witchcraft and so on. We should relinquish any thoughts of this kind. Now, as Westerners, we might laugh at the suggestion that witchcraft might have some power for vengeance, but it's a real thing in the Tibetan Buddhist culture with its emphasis on the occult. Probably the most famous of all revenge stories is that of Milarepa, the great Buddhist saint and mystic, who went through incredible difficulties to become enlightened in one lifetime. There's an extensive narration of his life story on the website www.cosmicharmony.com, and I'm going to read some of it here because in many ways it's both so daunting and so inspiring. It takes a lot to purify the negative karma of revenge, but it can be done, as is shown in Milarepa's story, which goes like this. Milarepa was born into the family of Meledorje Sengi in the year 1052. His father was a trader in wool and had become wealthy by the standards of the time when his wife bore a son. The son was named Topaga, which means delightful to hear. And Topaga, later known as Milarepa, Miller, the cotton clad, lived up to his name as he had a beautiful voice and charmed his companions with his singing. The family lived in a large stone house that consisted of three stories held in place by a large central pillar and supporting columns, a mansion in comparison to the modest homes of his neighbors. The brother and sister of Milarepa's father had also settled in the area along with their families, and the clan would often congregate at the great stone house of Miller Dorje Senge. The family was well-to-do and generous, and became the darling of all the relatives and neighbors in the area. They would often gather at the house to enjoy feasts. The gathering of friends and neighbors would often fawn over the small children, the young son Milarepa, then called Topaka, and his sister Peta, who was 4 years younger. During this period, the family enjoyed the admiration and attention of their neighbors, ate only the finest food, and wore nothing but fancy clothes and jewelry. About this time, the father, Miller Dorje Senge, became gravely ill, and, accepting his impending death, called together the extended family and made known to all that he wanted his entire estate and all possessions put into the care of his brother and sister, until such time as Milarepa had grown and married Cezay, one of the neighboring girls who had been betrothed to him in childhood according to the tradition of the times. After the father's death, however, Milarepa's greedy aunt and uncle, who'd been given charge of the property, divided the estate between them, dispossessing Milarepa, his mother, and sister Peta of all their worldly possessions. They were forced to live with them in the lowest accommodations and were given only coarse food and even made to work in the fields. Over the ensuing years, their health suffered, their clothes were rough and tattered, and the heads of the two children became invaded by lice. The mother and her two children, who had formerly been the darlings of the village, now became objects of derision and abuse by all, who now spurned and ridiculed them. The story continues that when Milarepa became 15, his mother scraped together whatever she could and put on a feast for all who had been present when her husband had died. When everybody was eating and drinking the local beer called chang, she stood up and reminded everyone of what her husband had said on his deathbed. Now that Milarepa had attained his majority, she wanted all the property to be restored to them. However, the greedy relatives pretended that the property had been theirs all along and only loaned to her husband. They beat Milarepa's mother and the two children and threw them out of the house. And some of the relatives and neighbors were sympathetic to Milarepa's family, but were not strong enough to oppose the relatives. From then on, Milarepa's family lived very meagerly, forced to work hard for a bit of food or clothing. Milarepa's mother became increasingly bitter and eventually told her son to go to a local shaman or lama who practiced black magic and learn from him so that he could use spells against her enemies. She said that if Milarepa didn't succeed, she would kill herself. Milarepa went to the lama, who listened to his story and, saddened, decided to pass his knowledge on to the young man. Says the website, Milarepa absorbed all the teachings thoroughly and carefully carried out the prescribed ritual for 14 days. At the end of the ritual, the tutelary deities appeared to him in a vision with the bloody heads and hearts of 35 of the relatives who had most ill-treated him. The lama informed him that two of the guilty ones had been missed and asked Milarepa if he wanted their lives as well. He replied that he wanted them to be spared as witnesses to the power of his magic. Thus it came to pass that his two very worst enemies, the greedy aunt and uncle, were spared from harm. Now this is how his magic played out. There was a family wedding in the great stone house, and all those who treated him and his mother the worst were there celebrating. There was a big commotion outside, and some of the horses kept in the yard started kicking and running about, violently agitated, until one of them ran into the main supporting column of the three-story house with such force that the entire house came crashing down on the wedding party, with tremendous noise and force, killing everyone inside except for the aunt and uncle. All of this was observed by some of those sympathetic to the Milarepa family who were just approaching the house, says the website. Milarepa's mother quickly learned of the catastrophe and was ecstatic with cruel joy. She came gloating over the destruction that her son had caused, telling everyone what joy her son had brought to her aging heart by causing so much death and destruction. The relatives of the dead were quite upset at the tragedy, and more so to learn of her gloating. They talked it over, but were divided on whether to get together and kill her in revenge or to go after her son Milarepa, who had directly caused the destruction. After due consideration, they decided to find and kill the son. Soon, word of their plans got back to the mother, so she sent a message to her son, along with several gold pieces she'd got from selling the remaining half of her plot of land. In her message, she described her joy at his success and requested him now to launch a powerful hailstorm in the area, ruining the crops of their enemies and striking fear into their hearts so as to prevent further retaliation. Milarepa received the note from the pilgrim courier and gave the gold pieces over to the sorcerer Lama, requesting him to teach him the art of launching hailstorms. Armed with this new magic, Milarepa traveled incognito back to his homeland and set up his ritualistic site on the hillside overlooking the valley of his homeland below. He began his incantations, and soon dark clouds began to gather, and then a succession of three powerful hailstorms utterly ruined the entire barley crop of that year, a crop that had promised to be one of the heaviest in years. After the destruction, Milarepa retreated to a cave in the hillside to escape the cold wind and lit a fire for warmth. After a few hours, he heard some of his former neighbors walking by the cave he had taken refuge in. They had guessed who was responsible for this fresh mischief and were immensely angered by all the destruction he'd caused, first to the 35 people killed in the wedding party, and now to the season's rich harvest of barley, utterly laid to waste. The men were talking amongst themselves, saying as they walked past the cave that if Milarepa fell into their hands at that very moment, their vengeance could hardly be satisfied by chopping his body into tiny bits. Such was their anger. At that instant, one of them spotted the fire and guessed that it was Milarepa himself taking refuge in the cave. They hurried quickly and quietly away to go gather a party to go after him. Meanwhile, as soon as they had left, Milarepa made good his escape and journeyed back to the sorcerer Lama. The Lama congratulated Milarepa on his success, but by now Milarepa was deeply repenting all the evil deeds his mother had urged him to commit. He longed for religion and wanted to be delivered from committing further evil acts. He worried greatly over the heavy debts of karma he'd incurred through his evil actions and could think of nothing else. Later, when he told the Lama of his concerns, the Lama sent him to another teacher who, seeing he himself was not the right teacher for Milarepa, told him to go to the great Lama named Marpa the Translator. When Milarepa first heard the Lama utter the name Marpa, he felt a thrill go through his body, says the website. Suddenly all his hair stood on end and tears of joy started flowing from his eyes. He set out, thinking of nothing else but the moment he would finally set eyes on his new guru. In the meantime, Marpa had a dream in which his guru gave him a slightly tarnished scepter and told him to wash it from a pot of holy water. This Marpa did, and it came up so brilliant that its light shone throughout the universe with the blessings of all the Buddhas. Marpa belonged to a lineage that believed very much in omens, so he took this to mean that his chief disciple was coming and he was to purify all his negative karma so he could attain enlightenment. Marpa then got up and went out to plow his field until he saw Milarepa coming up the road. The website describes their meeting like this. As soon as Milarepa approached and laid eyes on the Lama Marpa, an inexpressible bliss gripped him, and for a few moments he lost consciousness of his surroundings, swept up in an ecstatic state. As soon as he had recovered, he addressed Marpa as Reverend Sir and asked him where he might find the faithful disciple of the famous Saint Naropa, who was called Marpa the Translator. Marpa showed no emotion and said he would introduce Milarepa to Lama Marpa only if Milarepa would finish plowing the field. Marpa gave him some of the local beer to drink, which Milarepa did to the last drop before starting the plowing. He plowed until the task was done, even though someone came to tell him that Lama Marpa had arrived. Marpa took the total drinking and the plowing as signs of his new disciple's thoroughness and willingness to work towards the spiritual goal. The website goes on, after that initial meeting began a period during which Marpa held out the goal of spiritual instruction and kept Milarepa busy at strenuous physical labors building various stone edifices. By nature, Marpa was outwardly a rough and tyrannical teacher, but inwardly he was all love and compassion. By the previous omens and Milarepa's recounting of his evil deeds, Marpa knew there was a great deal of evil karma to be worked out, so he pretended to be always short-tempered and demanding with a sincere and faithful lad. He had Milarepa build a stone structure on a high rocky ridge, only to have him tear it down again and take all the rocks and boulders back to where they were found, telling him he changed his plans and now wanted a new structure built in another place. This was repeated on three different ridges until finally he had Milarepa build a grand, many-storied edifice on yet a fourth ridge. Throughout the tasks, Milarepa never lost faith that he would receive the instructions he was looking for and put forth a Herculean effort, moving stones that ordinarily could only be moved by the combined strength of three men. He put forth such strenuous effort that he wore his body out until his back was one great sore from carrying rocks and mortar. His arms and legs were all cracked and bruised. Yet he continued working on, every day hoping at last to be favored with some religious instruction. Out of sympathy with his wounds, Marpa showed him how to pad his back and allowed him to rest while his body healed, but never did he allow Milarepa to avoid any of the building work that he had set out for him to complete. Now, during all this time, Marpa was teaching his other students, but when Milarepa tried to join them, Marpa drove him away with angry shouts and fierce beatings. Each time, Milarepa would be plunged into deep despair to the point of committing suicide. But then Marpa's wife, Damema, would comfort him, saying the Lama would surely soon give him teachings. She gave him a rare turquoise as an offering when next Marpa was giving a big initiation. But Marpa refused the precious stone and said Milarepa could only stay if he had something of his own to offer. But when Milarepa had nothing, Marpa manifested great anger, threw the young man to the ground and threatened to beat him. Milarepa left the house weeping. The next day, Marpa asked him if the previous day's events had shaken his faith. But Milarepa said they were only the result of his own evil deeds and again burst into tears. Again the Lama became angry, asking him how he dared to blame the Lama by his weeping in his presence. And that, of course, made Milarepa even more miserable. He decided that he'd better find another teacher, as Marpa would never give him teachings. So went to Damema and told her. She gave him some relics of Marpa's guru, Naropa, as a gift, and sent him to another highly realized teacher named Lama Ngongopa, with a note sealed with Marpa's own seal, asking him to teach Milarepa. The Lama was happy to take on Milarepa as a student on the recommendation of the great master Marpa, but one of the first tasks he set him was to go to a nearby province where his students were often accosted and robbed and cause a great hailstorm to reap the crops and teach the people a lesson. Milarepa was not happy with this, but needing teachings, he did as the Lama asked. The website described what happened. Soon a large and violent storm gathered and let loose huge quantities of rain and hail. After the storm had passed, Milarepa saw that the fields of grain had all been wasted. The hills around were deeply cut by ravines, and many of the domestic animals of the residents, as well as even birds, rats, and other animals, had perished in the storm. Finding a shepherd who had lost his entire flock, Milarepa made known to him that the people of the province had better refrain from robbing the religious pilgrims passing through the area, or risk having more disastrous hailstorms visited upon them. On hearing of this, the people were profoundly impressed with the power of Lama Ngongopa, and not only refrained from robbing the pilgrims in the future, but many of them became devoted followers and faithfully served him. Now Milarepa returned to the Lama and complained that he'd come for teachings, but all he'd done was create even more negative karma. The Lama told him not to worry. All those who died in the flood would become students of the Buddha's path in the future, and he started teaching Milarepa. Milarepa listened well and practiced hard, but no matter what he did, he couldn't make any progress at all. This puzzled the Lama, because even his lowliest student should have had some sort of experience by that point. Milarepa guessed it was because he didn't have Marpa's blessings, but didn't say anything and just continued trying. The website goes on, at about this time, Lama Ngongupa received a summons from Marpa to join him for a great religious event. The letter also stated that Lama Ngongupa should return the wicked person who would take refuge with him. The Lama went to Milarepa's cave and read the letter to him. At this, Milarepa confessed that indeed it was not Marpa that had sent him there for instruction, but his wife, the Reverend Mother Damema. The Lama then stated in that case they had been engaged in totally profitless work. Anyway, the Lama and his entourage packed up and travelled to the residence of Marpa. When they were a short distance away, the Lama sent Milarepa ahead to inform Marpa that they were near so that he could send some refreshments, according to the Tibetan custom. At Marpa's house, Milarepa first bumped into Damema, Marpa's wife. They greeted each other like mother and son, but when Milarepa went to meet Marpa, the great master kept turning his back towards him. And when Milarepa asked him to prepare a reception for Lama Ngongupa, Marpa became angry at him. However, the Lama Ngongupa was duly welcomed, and later Marpa put on a great feast for everyone. But at the feast, Marpa appeared angry with Ngongupa and asked him how he could give teachings to the wicked and evil Milarepa. So then the whole story of how Damema had given the relics and note to Milarepa came out. The website says that as Marpa turned to him, Milarepa quickly passed from a state of extreme terror to one of extreme anguish, feeling once again as if his heart were being torn out. He began trembling and could scarcely talk for his terror. He escaped from the feast, but was in such a state of misery that he decided finally to take his own life. Says the website, Lama Ngongupa sought to comfort Milarepa, as did many of the disciples who joined in to offer their own sympathies. But Milarepa remained in deep despair, bitterly repenting the black deeds he had previously committed that were now producing all his present suffering. Meanwhile, all the anger seemed to drain out of Marpa, and he became calm and mild and asked one of his disciples to go and bring Lama Ngongupa, Damema and Milarepa back to his presence. But this made Milarepa even more despondent. He envied the others, but as for himself, he knew that his teacher would only show fresh displeasure at him if he returned with the others. So he remained there still weeping with despair, and Lama Ngongupa remained with him to soothe him and make sure he didn't do anything rash. Marpa now sent Damema to request Milarepa to return, saying that he was now to be the honored guest. Damema went to him, smiling broadly, and told him that it appeared that Lama Marpa was now really going to favor him with some teachings. Milarepa very much doubted that this could be so, but nonetheless returned with the others and took all their seats around Marpa. Marpa explained that he had set Milarepa all the hard labor to help absolve him of his negative karma, and his own anger had been spiritually motivated only to incite repentance and purification. That's all we had time for today, and now we must say farewell. Please dedicate all positive potential from our time together to gaining enlightenment for all beings. Thanks, and goodbye.